Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Whatever my partisan affiliation, I don't want to retire from this place one day and look back and think I made our country less safe for my children or grandchildren.
You're listening to the National Security Podcast, the show that brings you expert analysis, insights, and opinion on the national security challenges facing Australia and the Indo-Pacific. Produced by the ANU National Security College.
Welcome to the National Security Podcast. I'm Rory Medcalf, head of the National Security College at the Australian National University. Today's podcast is recorded on the lands of the Ngunnawal and Ngambri people, and I pay respects to their elders. Today, our guest is Senator James Patterson, Liberal Senator for Victoria, but importantly for this conversation, the Shadow Minister for Home Affairs and the Shadow Minister for Cyber Security. And James, welcome to the program.
Great to be back with you.
And you are back with us because I would note that you joined us a couple of years ago, I think then in your capacity as chair of the Parliamentary Joint Committee on Intelligence and Security. And the national security landscape has moved pretty dynamically and in some ways very frighteningly in the years since then. So it is an important moment to welcome you back. I'd like to have a wide-ranging conversation with you today about national security, national preparedness, national resilience, really how can Australia advance and protect its interests and values in this pretty confronting international environment. So let's go there in a moment. But first, I actually want to thank you for your personal support of an initiative we have at the National Security College. And that's an initiative we call NS23, which is our program of briefings for parliamentarians, sponsored and supported by the Foreign Minister, Penny Wong, the Shadow Foreign Minister, Simon Birmingham, yourself, and of course, Peter Khalil from government and now chair of the Parliamentary Joint Committee. So thank you for supporting that program because that has, I think, achieved a lot this year in helping us build a shared awareness across the political spectrum of the security challenges facing Australia.
I agree, Roy. It's an incredibly important program, particularly because most members of Parliament do not have a professional or academic background in national security. But given the times we're living in, we are called upon to make decisions about that almost every day. And there is no professional education for MPs other than what you are providing to us through this program. And I think it really has already enhanced the level of knowledge in the Parliament.
Well, thank you. And we hope to keep this going and really extend those conversations to parliamentary staff as well in the near future. But let's go to some of the really substantive issues at play in national security at the moment. And of course, we're recording this on the 18th of October, 2023. This has been really a very harrowing time in international affairs, most recently with the crisis, the conflict in the Middle East, precipitated by the horrific attack on Israel by Hamas, but now it's being extended into a really open conflict between Israel and Hamas into Gaza, and an awful humanitarian cost already. It would be useful to hear your perspective on this, particularly the question of how we maintain Australia's social cohesion at this time.
Mm. Look, it's an incredibly troubling and distressing turn of events for Israelis in particular because it has punctured their sense of safety and security that for the best part of the last decade they felt that they lived under. And it's actually a reminder to all of us, if even the IDF and the Israeli intelligence agencies can miss signs and a terrorist attack can be allowed to proceed without being foiled, then we can too. And we should never forget that terrorism threat hasn't subsided. Like you, I'm very concerned about the implications for social cohesion in Australia. It was very unfortunate to see some of those protests, particularly in Sydney, where inflammatory and potentially criminal incitements to violence occurred, in particular those chants of gas the Jews. Now, there have been calls for, if any of those people guilty of that were temporary visa holders, that their visas should be cancelled on character grounds, and I agree with that. But I think the even more disturbing truth is that probably most of those people were born here, were raised here, and were educated here, and nonetheless still think that's an appropriate way to behave, to racially vilify a minority and to call for violence against them. And that is a very big challenge for us to confront as a nation. How do people born and raised in our country think that that's okay? I think there's a lot of things that lessons that come out of that. The first is leadership is very important from political leaders. We have to be unambiguous about what is acceptable and what is not acceptable, and making sure we send a clear message about that. Secondly, I think our education system has a very important role to play, not just in teaching the virtues of tolerance and pluralism and diversity, but also teaching the virtues of Australian values and our place in the world and the distinctive freedoms that we enjoy because of who we are. And those are inseparable from the values we have. And if that's not inculcated in future generations, then I think you will see more events like this.
And this, I guess, is part of a larger conversation as well about the rights and responsibilities of citizenship in Australia.
Exactly right. Look, that's a really big question, a question for migrants who choose to come here and make their life here, and a question for those of us who have the great fortune of being born here. But if you do come here and you choose Australia, you are not just choosing our beaches and our weather and our sense of safety and security. You're choosing our institutions and our values and our social norms, and they need to be taught and upheld by everyone who comes here if we want to continue to enjoy the very unique civilization and society that we've built.
And across the political spectrum, how do you see the opportunity and the need now to effectively keep the temperature down, to keep the debate community responses at a level that doesn't sort of accentuate the problem further?
We have had in the Senate and the House of Representatives this week a bipartisan motion that condemns Hamas's behaviour and expresses solidarity with Israel and the Jewish people, but also expresses our concern for Palestinian lives too, that we know sadly have already been lost and will continue to be lost as a result of this conflict, which was initiated by Hamas, who bears the moral responsibility for that loss of life. And that was a really important statement by the Parliament. It was regrettable in my view that there was an amendment move that attempted to hijack what was a condolence motion, that it was supported by the Greens and some Teal MPs, and that both in the Senate and the House, the Greens voted against the ultimate motion because their amendment was not successful. That's very unfortunate, and it does make our task harder of sending that strong signal. The good thing is that it was still bipartisan, that the parties of government, the responsible parties of government, the Liberal and National parties and the Labor Party, and the majority of the crossbench in both chambers were able to support those motions.
You made a comment, I think, in the last day or so about how concerned you and Australians are about the lives and safety of the people of Israel, but also very much of Palestinian people and the people in Gaza who are suffering at the moment in the conflict. One really shocking incident in the past day has been the explosion at a major hospital in Gaza, and there's still debate, I note, in the public domain as to who bears responsibility for that catastrophic loss of life. Do you have any comment on that?
Well, it's very important to remember that Hamas is not just enemy of Israel and of the Jewish people, it's enemy of the Palestinian people as well. You know, when we talk about Gaza being the largest open-air prison in the world, it's Hamas who are the prison wardens of that prison, who don't allow the Palestinian people to leave, who refuse to engage in peace negotiations, who refuse to lay down their arms, and who in launching this attack on Israel knew that there would be response and knew that that would come at the cost of Palestinian lives, and have taken additional steps to make sure that that's the case. They store their weapons, they store their fighters, sometimes their command headquarters in civilian areas, in apartment buildings, in hospitals, in schools, in mosques, because they know that Palestinian civilian casualties are a propaganda tool that can be wielded against Israel. So we'll determine in due course who was directly responsible for this hit on the hospital, whether it was a misfired rocket from Hamas or Palestinian Islamic Jihad, or whether it was a missed fire from an Israeli airstrike. But ultimately, the moral responsibility lies with Hamas, and we must be very clear about that.
Let's move to the broader strategic situation. And when we spoke a few years ago, I asked you about your own journey, if you like, to being a voice on national security and being really a a leading player in your side of politics on these issues, but also working very much in that cross-partisan world of the Parliamentary Joint Committee on Intelligence and Security. If you could maybe recap a few steps along the way of your journey to becoming very focused on national security, and then I'd really like to open the conversation into the global strategic situation that Australia finds itself in.
Yeah, Rory, as we've discussed before, I didn't set out to be a national security parliamentarian. It's not my professional or academic background, and when I was first elected to the parliament, my focus was primarily on economics. And the first committees I chaired were the Senate Finance Committee and the Corporations and Financial Services Committee. And had we been in a more benign strategic environment and a more settled time in history, perhaps that always would have been the case. But I shifted my focus on to national security because I believe it's the most consequential challenge facing our country. It is the only one which is existential in nature. It's the only one that will determine whether or not my children are going to inherit a liberal democracy from us and a sovereign country or not. And the decisions that we make there are just so magnified in their significance that they require absolute focus from parliamentarians. But there was also a historical accident, which is that the Turnbull government, which I was part of, was contemplating an extradition treaty with China. I was offended as a classical liberal that we would ever extradite a citizen to face a justice system with a 99.9% conviction rate. We've just heard from Chung Lei what that justice system is like. And so I was offended on that principle, but I was also very concerned about the Chinese Australian diaspora and the way in which this would be another tool of coercion to be used against them, because of the Chinese Communist Party's view that if you are Chinese ethnically, no matter where you are in the world, no matter what your citizenship is, you owe obligations to Beijing. And so I said that I would cross the floor to defeat that if necessary. And from there, I became in that China watching camp and became very concerned about all the other signals we were receiving out of China on Xinjiang, on Hong Kong, on Taiwan, on Tibet, on so many issues.
And so if you look at the global situation facing Australia today, of course, there remains a very strong level of concern, I think, in the security community about the level of risk that Chinese power poses to Australia and the way that China uses its power, even as, I think, understandably, the government's pursuing a diplomatic stabilisation strategy. But at the same time, we have war in Ukraine, the Russian aggression against Ukraine, and everything that means for the rules-based system globally, and now this unfolding crisis in the Middle East. If you are taking a big picture look at Australia's security priorities and how, as a power with finite capabilities, we somehow advance and protect our interests and values in that world, where do you stand? In a sense, you may, if I'm being a little bit rude about it, you have the privilege of not being in government at present, and in theory, in opposition, that gives you a chance to take back and really take a strategic look, because you're not responding to the crises of the day, and there are many of them. But if you do take that strategic look, what on earth does Australia do in these circumstances?
Well, I certainly welcome the fact that some of the heat in the bilateral relationship between China and Australia has evaporated, that the tensions are less than they were. But in my judgment, that is purely as a result of a tactical change on Beijing's behalf, as it realised that the economic coercion campaign against Australia had failed, as it realised that that was damaging its international reputation and standing, and as it decided that its Wolf Warrior diplomacy writ large was unsuccessful in achieving its national objectives. And so it's made a tactical change away from that. But the underlying strategic challenges are exactly the same. They haven't changed at all, in my view. And the Chinese Communist Party's objectives of first achieving regional dominance and then using that as a platform for global dominance and supplanting the United States as the principal superpower is exactly the same and remains. And so the challenges for Australia remain. You talk about the conflict in Russia and Ukraine, and that is a very pressing challenge for the world. And Australia has an interest in that because of our values, but also because China is the principal economic sponsor of that war. If China cut off Russia, like the rest of the world has done, like most of the Western world has done, then that war could end tomorrow. But the continued financial support for the Russian economy from China facilitates that war and facilitates Russia's continued subjugation of the sovereignty of the people of Ukraine. And so, as far as I'm concerned, it is just one theatre, and we are facing a tide of rising authoritarianism. And whether it's in China, whether it's in Russia, whether it's in Iran, whether it's in North Korea, I think the same very steadfast response is required from liberal democracies. We must stand with our like-minded partners. We must stand with our allies. And we must stand for those countries that may not have traditionally fallen into either camp, that might be on the fence, but who jealously guard their own sovereignty and their right to self-determination, including in our own region.
And one argument that's been made, I think, with regard to the policies of previous governments, the governments that you were part of, perhaps arguably in contrast to policies of the current Australian government, is the way in which we approach those players in the middle. You know, Southeast Asia, for example. India perhaps is in a different position, but looking at engagement in our near neighbourhood, Southeast Asia and the Pacific, whereas you say there are countries that are hedging, that are in the balance, do you think we're getting the balance right? And is there any soul-searching perhaps on your side of politics as to whether perhaps the balance wasn't right at that time?
I think those differences have been exaggerated for political effect, and I think the policies that this government is putting in place are a continuation and in some areas an extension of the policies that the previous government put in place. But
they do look pretty effective.
Yeah, well, that we initiated the Pacific Step Up, anticipating what would happen over the next 5 years. I think that was a very foresighted investment in the Pacific, and we refocused our international aid program to our own region rather than trying to solve the problems of the whole world, which Australia, as a middle power, cannot ever do. And what the current government's doing is extending that even further, and I think that's a good thing. And I think had we been in government, we would have continued that too. It's very clear to me that our interests are most acute in our own region, and so we should be focused there. And it is absolutely appropriate for the foreign minister and others to have spent the time and focus that they have in our immediate region, because what the decisions that those countries make will be far more consequential for us in the strategic environment we're in than some much further away.
What about public awareness and debate on these issues? We talked a little earlier about the work we're doing to, if you like, improve the level of awareness in a contestable way, I believe, with parliamentarians and with those at that elite end of the spectrum. But there is, I think, a growing level of public anxiety about a whole range of security issues. And, of course, we can't have this conversation without talking about climate change and its impacts, or the impacts of the COVID pandemic, or those transnational issues that are not, if you like, state-driven. But how do you see the right balance for the political class in ensuring that there is public awareness but not a level of public alarm that's counterproductive?
Compared to where we were 5 years ago, I think we're having a much more honest conversation with the Australian public about the security challenges that we face, and I welcome that. I think that's really important. I think we have to treat the Australian public as they are, which is adults who are capable of processing complex information, and we'd be doing them a disservice if we withheld from them the grim realities of the world as it is. And so, for example, the communication around the Defence Strategic Review released by this government, and particularly Sir Angus Houston's observations that we're living in the most dangerous time in his lifetime. He's a very measured and mild-mannered person. For him to say something like that is a very significant statement, and I think the Australian people deserve to be taken into the trust of the government. Of course, there are classified things that can and never should be shared, but the flavour of the challenges that we face do have to be shared, because there may come a time, I hope not, but there may come a time where we ask the Australian public to make sacrifices to meet those challenges. And they would quite rightly be very upset with us if we haven't taken them along the journey about that in advance, so they know in advance what those sacrifices may be. And they're not going to support, in a political sense, the investment that we need in our defence and national security unless they understand how serious the threats are. Equally, we don't want to over-dramatise them. We don't want to frighten people unnecessarily. And we don't want to do anything which makes, for example, our Chinese Australian diaspora feel unsafe or not included in the Australian body politic. They have every right to participate in that just like anyone else, and they should never be singled out and victimised. And that's a really important balance we have to strike.
We'll be right back.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalised plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
In this disrupted world, Australia needs security professionals more than ever. Join the next generation studying at the ANU National Security College. Our programs uniquely fuse academic knowledge with practitioner experience and fit around your lifestyle with study offered online and on campus. Follow the link in the show notes for more information about programs and scholarships. the ANU National Security College. Engaging minds for a secure Australia.
So we've talked in one part of this conversation about ensuring social cohesion in the face of the conflict in the Middle East. We've also now spoken in another part of the conversation about the Chinese-Australian community and the way that they may feel alienated by the debate about strategic challenges in our region. And of course, one of the great strengths, a fundamental strength of Australia as a multicultural democracy, is that tapestry of backgrounds of Australian citizens. I would also bring India into that conversation because I think we can't have a conversation about sovereignty and national security at the moment without looking at the crisis between India and Canada, where, as we know, there's been an allegation made by the Canadian Prime Minister that's been vehemently denied effectively by the Indian government about the killing of a Canadian national who was, of course, an individual associated very closely with the Khalistani separatist movement in India. That must be a confronting conversation for people thinking about home affairs, home security in Australia, where we want, of course, a very quality relationship with the rising power that is India, with the democratic power that is India, but where also questions about sovereignty and the rule of law come into play. What's your view on that?
That was a very troubling development, and I haven't been briefed on that, and so I don't know whether those accusations are true. I certainly hope that they're not true, although I think it would be very unlikely that a Canadian Prime Minister would go to the steps of publicly revealing that in the Parliament if it wasn't on a very firm basis. And that would be very unfortunate because I think India and Australia and India and our other partners have a lot of work to do together and a lot of common interests and a lot of common values. And it's critically important that we welcome India as it is being, as a growing international power and as an important responsible contributor to international system, particularly in the Indo-Pacific. We want them to take an active role. We want them to take an assertive role. We want them to take a prominent role. That will be harder if India is engaging in behaviour like that, which I really, as I say, I hope is not true. From an Australian point of view, it's a relationship which I think we all know hasn't reached its full potential, which is particularly on the economic front, not yet reaching its full potential. We had the early harvest trade agreement. There was always envisaged there'd be a second stage of that. I hope this government is successful in finishing off what we started. And we can deepen those relationships, but we have to encourage India to behave consistent with its values and its principles too.
And I guess the bigger question that I would raise is a confronting challenge for Australia in the years ahead is going to be how to maintain the confidence of very diverse communities within this country where the politics, the geopolitics, the conflicts in the international system, whether they're conflicts in the Indo-Pacific, whether they're conflicts in the Middle East, whether they're conflicts in Europe, or whether indeed they're internal conflicts in major countries, all have the potential to spill over into the Australian community, the Australian system. Any general observations there on how we can maximise the integrity of Australia in those circumstances?
Yeah, I think Mike Burgess's warning as Director General of ASIO of the possibility for the spontaneous communal violence stemming out of some of these tensions overseas is one that we should take very seriously. And we, of course, understand when people come to Australia and make Australia their home, they don't completely separate or divorce themselves from their heritage and their right to feel very proud of their heritage, their right to want to have a continuing connection to their culture, their right to want to share that here in Australia with others. It would be very unfortunate, though, if the divisions which have defined societies which they have left are brought here to Australia and become an issue in Australia. We don't want our society to be divided on sectarian or religious or cultural lines as the way we do see happening overseas. So I think it is very important that in coming to Australia and committing to Australia, commit to being an Australian and the values of our country and the acceptance of pluralism and diversity and toleration, even when tensions are high and even when you're deeply and rightly concerned about friends and family at home who are facing very real challenges.
So how confident are you that we have the, if you like, the institutions, the security settings, but also the if you like, the broader policy settings of society, social engagement, communication, et cetera, reassuring the Australian community? How confident are you that we have all the architecture in place?
Well, I am I think we've got work to do. I am concerned that we're not as strong and united as we need to be for the strategic environment that we're in. And one of the issues, I think, is that we need to have a broad and unifying national identity, which we can all unite behind and connect with. It can't be a national identity which is thin, which is just about the things which we're distinct from each other on. That has to be broad and thick and about the things which we share. And I think it's really important that political leaders lead that conversation. So I think pride in our country, pride in the history of our country, pride in our institutions, pride in our symbols is really important. I'm never one of those people who say we should whitewash history and say that our country is perfect or has a perfect history. We should be honest about our failings. But if we think there's nothing particularly distinctive or special about Australia and we don't share that with people who come here and people who are born and raised here, then let's not be surprised when that loyalty and that commitment to Australia and its values are tested in times of crisis.
And of course, this is sensitive terrain because, as you know, recording a conversation today, we've just come out of the national experience of the Voice referendum, which I think was a pretty fraying experience for a lot of people involved. And we're still, as a nation, I think, coming to terms with what the result actually means. But if I read you rightly, you're saying that we need a national identity that is unified, but that also comes to terms with our history, including those aspects of our history that do involve, if you like, wrongdoing in previous generations. So I'm just curious to maybe draw you out on that a little further before we go to a few portfolio areas.
That's a very good summary. And I think there is unfinished business historically and even unfinished business in our constitution. I think if we ever contemplate constitutional change again, though, we have to try and build a broader consensus and obviously bipartisanship around it. One area where there is the potential to do that is to deal with the problem of the race power. It is the elephant in the room. It's the uncomfortable thing about our constitution. If we were starting a new constitution today, no one would vote for the inclusion of a race power. It was included in 1901 for explicitly racist reasons to target Asian migrants for discrimination. And in 1967, it was amended to include Indigenous Australians for strictly non-racist reasons, but it is still have this legacy of a power where the parliament can make laws for people of any race, including Indigenous Australians, but including Australians of any other race. And it wasn't that long ago that people like Noel Pearson and Marcia Langton and Linda Burney and Megan Davis supported removing the race power. And I support that too, because I think our constitution should be colorblind. And that was one of the features of this debate. I think Australians did vote for the unifying idea that we should all be treated equally in our constitution. But right now, the truth is we are not. And so I think if we ever go down this road again, we have to tackle that issue.
Let's turn to some areas that are really at the heart of your shadow portfolio. So cybersecurity is one of those. And I think it's anticipated that there'll be a cybersecurity strategy released before very long. There were, of course, cybersecurity strategies under previous governments, I think under Turnbull and Morrison, as well as international cybersecurity strategies. But strategy is one thing, delivery is another. How do you think Australia's doing in protecting the interests, the privacy, the wealth of Australians and Australia's institutions from cyber threats at the moment?
It has sometimes been said in this debate that Australia is 5 years behind the rest of the world, but in my travels, I'm yet to find a jurisdiction which is 5 years ahead of Australia, and I haven't seen anyone else point out a jurisdiction that we should copy.
Even in smaller countries where it's sometimes easier to get the pieces together?
There are countries who are doing good things, but there's no country in the world who I think is miles ahead of Australia. I think Singapore's doing some good things, Estonia's doing some good things, a lot of countries who are doing good things, but there is none who I think is doing anything materially different or better from Australia. Nor is there any country that solved this problem and dealt with this problem. So I think we've actually done a lot of good things in the country. The critical infrastructure reforms that we enacted are genuinely world-leading. They do not exist anywhere else in the world other than Singapore, who did it after us. The United States Congress would never agree to that, and it wouldn't be constitutional anyway. The investment in the ASD through the Red Spice program was a major and significant investment, and it will equip us to better defend our country in times of crisis. But there's obviously ongoing evolution of the threat, and therefore there needs to be an ongoing evolution of the response. One area that I'm concerned that there hasn't been an adequate response to yet is the risk of high-risk vendors from authoritarian countries. Now, whether that's cameras, drones, social media applications, other products, they pose a unique and troubling challenge to us if they are internet-connected and sophisticated devices. And they are all throughout our economy and all throughout our society, and we have to grip up how we deal with those things because these people are subject to the whims of authoritarian governments, and that is danger for our country.
So, of course, the high-risk vendor or the non-trusted vendor approach was, if you like, the solution on 5G some years ago, where Australia did play a leading role internationally. Are you advocating something similar across these other technologies? Or please explain what the, if you like, what the policy solution looks like, because, as you say, so much of this technology is already embedded around the country. It's going to be an enormous undertaking.
In the last year, I've led a series of audits that have demonstrated that the Australian government has very high exposure to some of these products, whether it is Hikvision and Dahua cameras, whether it is DJI drones, whether it is Huawei smart solar inverters. Either the Australian government or society are highly exposed to them, and, of course, in social media applications and other software as well. What I think we need from a government point of view is a central agency that maps this exposure, that gives mitigation advice, and in the future, before these products are purchased and embedded in our IT systems, warnings are given to prevent them from being happening. It shouldn't rely on an opposition senator to think of a risky product, ask questions, and find out whether in the government. There needs to be a central agency which deals with that. And if you're able to secure the government sector, then you can slowly widen that circle. You can widen that circle to defence industry, to critical infrastructure, and then to broader society. And I don't think that any of these high-risk products should be in any sensitive settings, and the government needs to lead that conversation, otherwise it won't happen.
So you've mentioned the institutional architecture for Australian national security, and that goes to the Department of Home Affairs, among other things, and you are Shadow Minister for Home Affairs. Now, there's a lot of speculation about the future of that department, which was established, I think, in 2017 under the Turnbull government, and which has, if you like, had a few of its constituent agencies, if you like, broken off or returned to the Attorney General's department under the current government. What's your view on the future of the Department of Home Affairs? Is it fit for purpose? If you were Home Affairs Minister in a future government, how would you look at the machinery of government?
Well, I would say it's more than a few. It's the AFP, it's the ACIC and AUSTRAC, and really all that is left in the Home Affairs portfolio is ASIO and Border Force. It's not the vision of the portfolio when it was constructed, and it is one of the great achievements of the former government, in my view, to bring together the operational and policy arms of all the domestic national security agencies. And we now have a situation where it isn't actually clear who the lead domestic national security minister is. Is it the Minister for Home Affairs or is it the Attorney General? And this has led to a series of problems. For example, the time taken to list a terrorist organisation and the ministerial consideration of that has blown out. We even had a terrorism listing recently where the Minister for Home Affairs was omitted from the process entirely, and what has been admitted to is now as an administrative bungle. I worry that small problems like that will escalate and cause real tangible national security risks for our country, and I think it doesn't make sense to have effectively demolished that portfolio as the government has. But you're right, there's a lot of speculation that even after the dismantling of the portfolio that we've seen, that there'll be yet even more of it to come. And I think that would be a really retrograde step. I think there is good sense in having those agencies together and also good sense in having the oversight at arm's length with the Attorney General. I think that was a really good structure where the Attorney General who approves the warrants for ASIO is not the minister who's responsible for ASIO. So they're not both responsible for oversight and operational outcomes. And that has been blurred now that some of those operational agencies have been put back into AGs.
There's also an argument, though, that the institution has never quite cohered in the way that it was intended. And of course, there's been speculation about whether the culture of that institution is fit for purpose. So just interested to draw you out further on whether things would simply be perfect if agencies were put back into the constellation, or whether in fact there's some bigger picture overhaul or review of the structure needed?
Culture is very important, and how these departments and portfolios are led is very important. And without making any kind of comments specifically about individuals, I think it is important that you have appropriate turnover at the top of departments like these, fresh eyes that come in and able to look at it with a fresh perspective and make sure that power isn't accumulated too much in the hands of any one individual or small groups of individuals. And if you get those cultural things right, then I think everything else follows. I think the settings are important and they should be unified, but that leadership, organisationally is very important too.
Before we wrap up, I want to ask you about the things that worry you. This has been a pretty sobering conversation, because most of the things we've talked about have been about risks to Australia's interests and values and about the ambitious but imperfect ways that we've really sought to mitigate those risks. Black swan events, or black elephant events, if you like, and for the benefit of listeners, of course, a black swan is a metaphor for the event that catches you completely by surprise, and a black elephant is the event that is actually staring at you, and yet you sort of claim to be surprised when this catastrophe happens. So many things in recent years have been in those categories, whether it's COVID-19, whether it's the conflicts we're seeing in the world. What are the other black swans or black elephants on your horizon that Australia should be preparing for?
I'm more worried about the elephants than the swans, just because there's no excuse for not acting on those. There will certainly be unanticipated events that we cannot possibly prepare for by definition, but we have no excuse not to prepare for the things that we know are risk of happening. And when it comes to those black elephants, I'm particularly worried about a nation-state-sponsored cyber attack on Australia, which would be utterly debilitating. As unpleasant, as uncomfortable, and as frustrating as cyber attacks like the ones we've seen happen to Optus and Medibank and Latitude and others happen, they pale into comparison to the severity of what would happen if a state-sponsored cyber actor attacked a critical infrastructure provider, something like an electricity network, a telecommunications network, a water or gas supplier, a logistics hub which is able to distribute food and medicine around the country. If those things were attacked and that been able to take offline, our whole country would be destabilized. And if that was a prelude to a regional crisis, a geopolitical crisis, or a military crisis or strategic crisis, then Australia could be prevented from projecting our power into the region in aid of our interests, our values, and our friends, and that would be utterly catastrophic. And so I don't want to see us lose sight of that really systemic and existential risk that we face. And I worry that the timelines that people have been talking about for potential conflict in the Indo-Pacific, whether it's over the Taiwan Straits or the South China Sea or the East China Sea or some other event, might come a lot quicker than we think it is. And at a time when, you know, the United States Congress is divided without a speaker, where it's invested not just in a war in Ukraine, but now potentially a war in the Middle East, opportunities do open up for other bad actors to move into that space and take advantage of that. And if this comes a lot quicker than we thought it might, then the preparations that we've taken for it will be wholly inadequate. And I just really worry there's that sense of urgency is still lacking, particularly when it comes to our military preparedness. The DSR was great. It described the strategic environment in exactly the right way, but we haven't seen the funding or the urgency to match that. And I worry by the time that we realise that we had to, it will be too late.
And that's the Defence Strategic Review, of which a sanitised version has been published. Potential black elephant, if you like, that I'd put on the table and get your view on, of course, is political dysfunction in the United States, or indeed whether it's intensified political dysfunction or the return of a Trump administration or some other outcome that's dysfunctional and bad for Australia's interests within the next year or two. It's not far away. What's your view on that?
I'm a big believer in the United States, but I'm worried about where it is today. And I think its institutions have withstood the pressure that they've been put under, but they have been pushed almost to breaking point. And we do not want to see any more events like disputed elections. We don't want to see any more of the unrest that followed from that, and we don't want to see it become much worse. We need a strong America that's engaged in the world, and for that we need a unified America. And I really hope that they're able to resolve those really, you know, deep chasms of internal difference that they have for the times that we are in, because the petty domestic disputes that we all have in our democracies, and Australia's not immune for this, will pale into comparison with the very serious external threats that we may face in the years that we have ahead. And I think we will look back and harshly judge ourselves if we haven't been able to rise above those to meet this challenge.
So it sounds like with the Prime Minister's looming travel to the United States and China, I think within the next few weeks, Australia's going to have its hands full in a policy sense. Any closing thoughts from you on, if you like, where the opposition stands in terms of bipartisanship?
Mm-hmm. My starting point in national security is to be bipartisan for two reasons. One, there is virtue in bipartisanship on national security, so we can't be separated by our adversaries. Two, government is in possession of information that oppositions are not and should deserve the benefit of the doubt. Having said that, we always, in a democracy, reserve the right to have our criticisms, but only when we think that they are warranted and they are necessary. And if we think the government's making mistakes, we will speak out. Actually, I want this government to be a great success when it comes to national security. As a partisan political operative, you often look for opportunities for failings to criticise them so you can get back into office, but I don't want them to fail in any way, shape or form when it comes to defence or national security or foreign policy, because the consequences for our country will be so, so dire. And our role as an opposition is to help this government make the best decisions it can make. Sometimes that will require external pressure to force their hand, to move more quickly, to take tougher decisions. Sometimes it will be being strategically silent to allow them to make the decisions and have the room they need to make those difficult decisions. And we will always be guided by the national interest. Whatever my partisan affiliation, I don't want to retire from this place one day and look back and think I made our country less safe for my children or grandchildren.
Senator Patterson, thank you very much. That's been a useful conversation. It's been pretty illuminating with your perspective on the challenges the nation faces, but also what you would project, I think, as bipartisan responses to those challenges. On the National Security Podcast this year, we've had the privilege of a conversation with the Minister, with Claire O'Neill, the Minister for Home Affairs and Cybersecurity, and we look forward to other opportunities to have government voices back on the podcast. But I think it's been really valuable to have your perspective here today. So thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Rory.